Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, Pennsylvanians who are victims of child sexual abuse have new support legally in prosecuting and suing abusers. Also, there's less obesity among very young children who are enrolled in the WIC program. We'll find out more as we speak with Jamie Bussell of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But first, Philadelphia City Council is positively prolific when it comes to considering and approving legislation. Over 15,000 bills and other measures have gone before council in the past 20 years, according to a Billy Penn Plan Philly analysis. But what has this meant in terms of significant achievement on critical issues? As the authors point out, Philadelphia remains the nation's poorest big city, with a poverty rate of nearly 25%. Also, its public schools are consistently underfunded. The controversial tax abatement program seems stuck in a perennial logjam. And there's more. WHYY reporters Max Marin and Jake Blumgart have returned to the roundup to help pull back the curtain on how council works and what it typically achieves. Jake is with WHYY's Plan Philly, and Max reports for WHYY's Billy Penn. Hi, Jake.
Hi there.
Hello, Max.
Hi.
So what prompted this analysis?
We wanted to find a way to audit the effectiveness of city council. It's a really difficult sort of nebulous task to do, but we figured if we looked at all of the legislation that was introduced over the last two decades, we could sort of piece together a picture of how kind of city government operates and, you know, whether it's succeeding or not, and try to come up with some way to look at that.
15,000.
15,000.
At least pieces of legislation.
Yeah, 15,000 bills and resolutions. So basically what that we broke that down to look at you know, what each bill kind of did and kind of lump them into these categories and figure out what they were actually tackling. And we found a lot of things that I think people who watch City Hall would not be surprised to hear in terms of, you know, just what makes up the huge volume of that legislation.
So give us a guesstimate, if you would, as to how much of all this involved substantive, if you will, issues like the deep poverty rate.
Right. I mean, I think when you get right down to it, most of what they're looking at is more kind of fun stuff like resolutions or like this very like narrow zoning bills or streets bills or things like that. But that doesn't mean they don't pay attention to the larger policy points. And that's kind of like another reason we wanted to focus on this is because, you know, right now cities are where a lot of policymaking is getting done because at the state level, there's not a lot happening. In Congress, there's not a lot happening, and everything is kind of stuck. And here we have a system that, whether you like it or not, does actually produce some results. But I would say, you know, the major, you know, it's kind of hard to quantify, like, what the number of, like, major policies were, especially because some of them do come from the mayor's office. Yeah. So we couldn't quite, you know, say those were the provenance of council per se. But there have been some really important wins that council put through on its own, like paid sick days legislation was a big one from a couple of years ago.
Its real power, though, lies in real estate.
Right. So our analysis found, I mean, first of all, just to give people listening in a perspective, you know, of those 15,000 bills, just to show you how, you know, effective council is at passing what it introduces, we found that about 75% of all bills, so three out of every four bills, passes. And about 92% of these resolutions that they bring in pass. So, you know, on average, we're looking at a very, very effective body if you're looking at just the sheer pass rate. But what we found is that one of four of those bills is really just a by right function, dealing with, as Jake said, around like real estate issues or planning issues in districts. And these are just kind of things that are introduced, like I want to change the zoning on your block. I'm going to introduce this bill to do that, and it's going to pass without any fanfare or opposition. This is a part of a practice known as council manic prerogative, which is somewhat come under fire in recent years in terms of how different lawmakers wield this power. But we found that that's a huge part of what they're doing. And then we kind of look at some of the other smaller issues that they're working with a lot of the time. And, you know, what you see is that you don't really see a bill going to the floor here unless it has the support to pass. So, you know, bills that really are introduced and then fail, which is just a very small number of them, don't tend to go and actually get voted on. They tend to just die, you know, behind the scenes.
Yes, as you write, proposals die in glorious deaths all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Or murder by committee. Explain.
Right. So it basically gets stuck there. Because they need to they don't want to move things to where it's going to be a debate or a fight on the floor where, you know, somebody could be embarrassed. Because as one of the politicians explained to us, if you think there's going to be a fight on the floor and your bill might lose, and but people are going to have to make a hard vote on it that they're going to hear from protesters and from the other people who don't want it to pass, then in the future, they are not going to vote for your stuff either. And so the example here with the plastic bag bill or the plastic bag ban bill, where they moved that forward a few years ago and then just kind of let it languish there behind the scenes because they didn't have the votes to move it forward and they didn't want to make the other members make a hard vote. And now they're trying again. And they think this time they might actually have the votes. But if they tried again that first time, that would have turned off a lot of people, they felt. So you kind of get this sense that they try to do everything kind of behind the scenes and in such a way as to not bring conflict into the public eye. Mm.
But as observers, do you feel that this process just takes entirely too long in getting substantive issues addressed and resolved?
That's certainly a criticism that a lot of people feel. Mm-hmm. A lot of people like to look at their government and say they're not doing anything, or they're not really making fast enough moves on these issues or the issues that are important to me. But I think what you'll see is a lot of bills coming forward in the last couple years in which council has really separated itself and tried to make a difference. You have council members who are trying to develop their own individual political brands, and you have them introducing pretty meaningful citywide legislation in a higher volume. Now, not all of it is getting passed, but we did kind of trace an uptick in the number of these substantive policies. Jake mentioned paid sick days. There's this domestic workers bill that has just gone in right now. There is a number of these policies, and we're also looking at a time when city council is just with three new members coming in next year. Four new members coming in next year.
And one of whom is with the Working Families Party,
right.
Kendra Brooks.
Yeah, so you really have,
some promise of some real change.
Some historic shakeup happening.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to that movement toward, or continue with that movement toward substantive policy. Just for a moment, let's talk about the controversial tax abatement program. And again, essentially, it offers a 10-year property tax abatement to new residential construction. Opponents have said it is robbing the school district of funding. And again, the new council members, some might want to kill it or at least drastically change it. So Council President Darrell Clark wants to get some movement happening on this before the change in January. Jake?
Right. So it
Do you
looks
see that
like,
happening?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it looks like this is actually going to move this time. I mean, as long as I've covered council, there have been talks about trying to change the abatement. And there have been numerous bills that have been dropped that just like went nowhere, never even made it to the committee. So the other week, a council member introduced on behalf of the council president at the last possible second a bill to change the abatement and basically have its value. I don't really want to, say that I 100% think this will happen because, all sorts of stuff can happen in those last couple weeks. This is the furthest along a reform push has gotten that I've witnessed. And I think there's a real serious chance that it could move here. I think there's a possibility that council members more on the left will continue to try to push for reform next year and maybe even the total elimination of the abatement. But I don't really think there's going to be the votes for that. This is kind of what abatement reform is probably going to look like.
So back to the process. When it comes to ambitious legislation, just because it might even receive council approval doesn't mean it will take effect. And you offer the example of Councilmember Cindy Bass's stop-and-go legislation. And again, a stop-and-go is a small deli or convenience store which might offer shots of whiskey, for instance.
Right.
So
Right. So you have a lot of bills that do end up getting passed too, and this is also why any council member who touts their ability to like pass a lot of bills, you know, you have to look at each individual one and see, well, what does it really do? What happened to the bill when it got passed between the time you introduced this ambitious proposal to crack down on one issue or another? So in the example of the stop and go bill, what happened was, you know, there was a lot of controversy around this. If people recall back in late 2017, deli store owners, these stop-and-go owners, were claiming that they required this bulletproof glass to sort of stay safe, and there's just a history of criminal incidents in these environments. And then there was community members who said that these places are really just a scourge on the neighborhoods. And it was this big fight, lots of protests. And what ends up happening in that moment is that council lawmakers feel pressure to sort of amend and tweak the bills to basically water them down as much as possible. So what ended up getting passed in the end was a bill that would leave it up to LNI, a city agency, to decide whether to enforce this issue several years down the road. Now, a lot of critics at the time basically said that's effectively nothing happening at all, because, you know, who's going to follow up on this? Who's going to really see to it to make it happen, right? These things happen like boom, big flashy news headline in the moment, but, you know, where is the actual enforcement going to lie?
So it still feels as if we're pushing the boulder up the mountain.
Yes.
At the risk of it rolling back down. Yeah.
Right. In a case like that, it's like the follow through is not guaranteed. Now, if the politician in question still wanted to kind of put pressure on the agency years later to, you know, kind of make something happen, yeah, maybe something could happen. But I think the city charter is stuffed with these lines about, you know, a certain agency will do such and such a thing at such and such a time. And have they done that most of the time? We don't really know. But it seems like probably not.
So with this new wave, if you will, of council members who are going to be joining the body in January, mm-hmm. three Democrats, one Working Families Party member, do you think they can cut through this process? They've got a lot of energy, it seems.
It's going to be interesting to watch it unfold and see how the different alliances get formed between different members of council. There are definitely, you can already identify with some of the new lawmakers where their allies are, and they already have political support there. But, you know, the more so-called progressive wing of city council is certainly going to, the stakes are pretty high for them to introduce some bold legislation. And there's certainly like a hunger and appetite for that locally in Philadelphia. We've seen just a surge of this progressive voting base that's also turned into a progressive lobbying base on city council that's really pushing for the city to make big strides towards some of these like populist ideas associated with people like Bernie Sanders and others. And, you know, we have Councilmember Helen Gim has already sort of been taking the lead on this. And I think that Kendra Brooks, the Working Families Party candidate, is going to have some support for bold ideas if they come.
But I think it's worth noting that they're not going to have a majority in all likelihood. That's not going to be, you know, most of the new council members do not have those precise politics, even mm-hmm. if they, you know, I'm sure all would identify right. as being progressive and left of center and whatnot. But there are gradations on that.
It'll be interesting to watch in the new year. So, all right. Jake Bloomberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, of course.
He reports for WHYY's Play in Philly. Max Maron, a pleasure as well.
I'm always happy to be here.
Good to have you back. Reporter for WHYY's Billy Penn. Stay tuned. There is some good news about childhood obesity rates in New Jersey. We'll be talking about that in just a moment on the Radio Times Regional Roundups. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's always nice to talk about good news. And for the next few minutes, we'll be looking at the falling obesity rate among very young children who are enrolled in the WIC Federal Nutrition Program. The rate has been dropping over the past 10 years in numerous states and territories. And in New Jersey, the picture is particularly striking. 15% of 2 to 4-year-olds were obese as of 2016. The number was closer to 20% in 2008. So, why the change? And is the trend a positive indicator regarding obesity in children across the board? Also, despite this positive development, fewer moms and young children are participating in WIC. We'll discuss all this with Jamie Bissell, Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which has released a report about childhood obesity. Jamie, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And before we get going, here's the email address. It's radiotimes@whyy.org. or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So I'm guessing this is encouraging news. This is how you're reading the numbers?
It absolutely is really encouraging news. So the obesity rate amongst children, as you referenced in the WIC program, actually declined in 41 states and territories between 2010 and 2016. Obesity declined among this group nationwide as well, and among all racial and ethnic groups studied. So this is widespread declines in obesity rates, and certainly really good, really positive, really encouraging news. That shows real progress is possible in our efforts to help all kids grow up at a healthy weight.
Jamie, remind us, who does WIC cover?
Sure. So WIC is a federally funded program for low-income pregnant women, new moms, infants, and children under the age of five. And it provides a whole host of resources and supports, from supplemental healthy foods to nutrition education, promotes breastfeeding and supports nursing moms, and a slew of other health care and social service referrals. It serves approximately 6.3 million people, actually in 2018, including nearly half of all infants born in the United States. So it's an incredibly important federal program that we have in this country.
And what is the definition of obesity in very young children and the risks?
So we generally look at it according to percentage. So our youngest kids would be considered suffering from obesity if their percent is at 95% or greater, overweight is 85%, and it's a mathematical calculation that looks at their height and weight and certainly takes into account growth trajectory, if you will.
So if a young child is obese, does this set the stage for a lifetime of health challenges?
So I think the important piece of information here is that if we can actually get kids to a healthy weight by kindergarten, their weight trajectory is much more likely to be retained on that healthy weight path through adolescence and early adulthood and through adulthood. So couldn't emphasize enough the importance of early intervention, addressing this early. It's much easier in a whole host of ways. And again, critically important that we can get all kids to a healthy weight by kindergarten.
The fact is, according to a project by the foundation called The State of Childhood Obesity, childhood obesity costs, is it $14 billion a year in health expenses?
It is. So each year, the U.S. spends about $14 billion on childhood obesity alone, and between estimates of about $150 billion to $210 billion on adult obesity. And so although over the past decades of increases, the national obesity rate for kids has held relatively stable in recent years, the important piece here is that childhood obesity rates still remain stubbornly and historically high. And not only does that put millions of young people at greater risk for really serious health conditions like high blood pressure, like type 2 diabetes, like heart disease, like asthma, we see huge health care costs. And so that's really important. This has huge, huge repercussions economically, physically, et cetera.
So back to the drop in obesity rates among very young children in the WIC program. Jamie Bissell, what we're seeing today is reflective of changes that were made, what was it, like about 10 years ago during the Obama administration?
Exactly.
Tell us about that.
So, sure. So one of the hypotheses in terms of what's driving the decline is that changes made to the WIC program in the last decade may be having a real impact. And so that's why it's so important that we make sure that WIC is reaching everyone who is eligible. So the package of foods and beverage covered by WIC that were actually updated in 2009 to include more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains, lower fat milk. And again, we'll need some more time to know definitively if these shifts contributed to the drop in obesity, but certainly that's one of the hypotheses.
So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation wants Congress to allocate more funding for WIC and, as you mentioned, to increase eligibility. Let's look some more at eligibility. Who would you like to see covered by WIC? who doesn't receive benefits now, who might be slipping through the cracks?
Yeah. So, you know, we're asking for an increase in WIC funding to extend eligibility to postpartum moms through the first 2 years after the birth of a baby and to children through the age of six. So today, children are no longer eligible for WIC once they turn five. We also know that that's where we see sort of the precipitous decline in participation as eligible children participating in the program get older. So as an example, we have data back from 2015 where almost 77% of infants were eligible enrolled, and then we see a real precipitous decline by the time that child is 4 years old. So we need to be doing everything that we can to ensure that not only is the program reaching everybody who's eligible for it, but to look at some extensions, and we believe that extending the program through a child's six to age six would be really impactful.
Are there barriers that are tough to navigate?
So I think there are several things here. And again, we've talked about declines in participation where we've actually seen some of the largest declines in the program history over the last 2 years, although we're starting to see some turnaround there. What certainly has not been helpful has been some of the shaming in the media from policymakers around participation in public benefit programs in general. And no surprise, the program has seen the chilling effects of anti-immigration rhetoric in this country. So I think those are things that are potentially driving a decline. There's certainly also macro issues. The economy has improved. We know that when this happens, those who are often eligible don't participate as much, as there is this misbelief that other people need the program more. And so you see folks not participating, not because they're not eligible, but because they deem others more in need. So, you know, there's a whole host of factors that are impacting the decline. And then I think there's some great opportunities to improve the program, whether that's around streamlining the programming, making it a whole lot more accessible, particularly to millennial moms who are very tech savvy. And so, you know, for example, using technology to streamline the retail process. Other improvements, you know, could be done or needed in the actual shopping experience. So addressing some of, you know, those challenges in the retail setting through helping all states transition to the electronic benefit transfer system. So again, I think, sorry.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Yeah, no, you go on. I'm good.
So what I wanted to get back to was, you know, again, the foundation wants Congress to allocate more funding for WIC, but at the same time, we find, you know, I guess it's sister program SNAP, the Trump administration, wants to cut benefits to about 3 million people, and that is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So do you see, with the political tenor as it is, more funding coming the way of the WIC program?
I like to hope so. I think there are certainly, you know, differences in SNAP and WIC, given that WIC really is a supplemental program where SNAP provides essentially a shopping basket of foods. You know, again, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, as well as WIC, are, you know, arguably two of the most important federally funded programs that we have that really lift families out of poverty. And we need to do everything that we can to continue to maintain their program's integrity and power and impact that they have for families. Specifically, you know, on SNAP, given that it's one of the most effective ways we have to help lower-income Americans be lifted more than 3 million people out of poverty in 2018 alone. We know that SNAP reduces hunger. It improves lifelong health and economic outcomes. So, you know, the proposals that we've seen over the last, especially year or so, needlessly would make life much more difficult for millions of vulnerable kids and families. And so we continue to urge the department to withdraw any rules that would do so much more harm to so many people.
So, all right. So focusing again on obesity, in very young children for the moment. The mm-hmm. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has released beverage guidelines for infants and children. And parents and caregivers, take note. You know, mostly milk and water for the first 5 years.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. And this was really significant, actually, the issuance of these beverage guidelines. It was the first time that the leading child health organizations came together, and exactly what you just said sort of identified what should our youngest kids be drinking, because I think there is a lot of confusion out there, especially amongst parents. And so this is, you know, really comprehensive, easy to digest information. And absolutely, it should be, for the most part, milk and water, and needing to stay away from sugar sweetened beverages, because we know that that is absolutely where the bulk of additional excess calories are consumed, particularly for our youngest kids.
Well, juice boxes are perceived by many as being helpful.
Yeah, they are. And I think the important thing is just to be really careful around reading labels and understanding where, in fact, it's added sugar, because kids don't need that. And so I think to the extent we could be doing everything that we can to support parents in terms of, you know, enhancing their knowledge and education around that, and, you know, reading the labels and understanding when there's added sugars. And the same holds true for some of the alternative milk products, where, it, you know, if it's not medically prescribed, some of the alternative milks have a significant amount of added sugar. So I think there are a lot of places where parents would be surprised to learn the extent to which those added sugars are appearing in, you know, what typically comes across as, you know, healthy drinks for their kids.
So for children 5 and under, cow's milk is best. Are we talking about whole milk or?
You know, it's whole milk, and then kids are transitioned at the age of 1 off of that, but it is cow's milk and water. And when it can be, you know, certainly exclusive breastfeeding for, you know, the infants for several months of their life.
So, Jamie Bussell, let's tackle food deserts. Many children who experience poverty live in places where there just isn't access to healthful, affordable, fresh food. Is this a huge piece of the puzzle in battling childhood obesity?
So we'll say that with this issue, arguably the most complex public health challenge of our time, there is no magic silver bullet here that if we're going to do, you know, A, we're going to see, you know, huge declines. This is really about a comprehensive, holistic approach. Certainly food access is a piece of that puzzle. But again, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that this is going to take, you know, preventing obesity will require leaders at all levels, federal, state, and local, to take action to help all kids grow up at a healthy weight. It's going to take every single sector, and it's going to take a multi-pronged, holistic approach to this. And again, we've been working on food access for a long time. Everybody deserves access to healthy, affordable, fresh, wholesome foods. Everyone deserves access to safe places to be physically active, health-promoting schools, health-supporting, you know, daycare centers. So an important piece of the puzzle, but again, no sort of magic bullet here. It has to be kind of a comprehensive suite of approaches in communities and states and in the nation if we're really going to turn the tide.
Interesting article done on a study conducted by New York University School of Medicine. A child's proximity to a fast food restaurant can have a direct impact on the odds they will become obese. Mm-hmm. The study was done in New York City and found that 20% of the kids living within a half block of a traditional fast food restaurant were obese. Nearly 40% were overweight. And the obesity numbers dropped for every half block removed from that restaurant. So, I'm wondering what parents can take away from this, especially parents, again, who do not have access to the fresh foods that might help keep a healthy body weight.
So, again, you know, I think that we know that choices people make are based on the choices people have. And so for us, it's about ensuring that everybody has healthy choices and the best opportunities to live the healthiest, best life possible. And so ensuring that every community has access to healthy, affordable foods, and not, you know, just places that are satiated with, you know, fast food, you know, densely populated fast food outlets.
And as you referenced earlier too, Jamie, the importance of exercise, it goes hand in hand with good eating to maintain a healthy body. Is there enough focus on this, in your opinion, within the academic world, say, in providing enough space for kids to get some exercise during the day if they can't safely do so in their neighborhoods?
Yeah, I think that it's a great point that this needs to be about the energy balance equation. We can't be exclusively focused on one side or the other. And we know that the physical activity piece has huge impacts on all the comorbidities that are associated with obesity. Not to mention, you know, the positive influences on your mental health. And so we need to be pushing schools to ensure that kids have opportunities during the school day to be physically active, whether that's through PE or recess. We need to ensure that communities have safe, walkable, bikeable routes, whether to school or the array of other destinations. But I do think it is absolutely an important part of, you know, that equation, and that we can, we need to be promulgating supports for both opportunities to eat well and also be physically active every day.
We've got about 30 seconds left, Jamie Bissell. So next steps at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in looking at the obesity rate and perhaps getting it even lower, especially among young children on the WIC program?
Yeah, absolutely. We remain deeply, deeply committed to this issue. We've been in it for well over a decade and a half, continue to be committed to reducing the rates of obesity across the nation. We know it won't be easy. It's not going to be quick. We've dedicated more than $1 billion to helping all kids grow up at a healthy weight. We're going to continue to do that. Great resources at stateofchildhoodobesity.org if you're interested in, you know, additional data, a narrative, the policy recommendations, but we are not taking our foot off the pedal. So,
all right, Jamie Bissell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jamie Bissell is Senior Program Officer at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Just ahead, Pennsylvania State Representative Mark Rossi. He'll talk about new laws which help victims of child sexual abuse. Stay tuned. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. Pennsylvania laws regarding prosecution of the sexual abuse of children just got tougher. Governor Wolf has signed legislation which ends the statute of limitations for criminal prosecution of child sexual abuse crimes in future cases. Also, if a victim wants to sue, they have until they are 55 years old. Secrecy agreements which keep child sex victims from talking to investigators will be invalid. And penalties will be increased for people who are required to report such abuse but fail to do so. This comes in the wake of last year's grand jury report, which found that hundreds of cases of alleged child sexual abuse in Pennsylvania's Roman Catholic Diocese occurring over seven decades, had been covered up. Governor Wolf signed the bills on Tuesday in Reading, the home district of Democratic Representative Mark Rossi himself, a survivor of sexual abuse by a priest when he was a child. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, here is the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mark Rossi, welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You have been very open about your own personal story, and we'll talk some more about this in just a bit. But Mark, as someone who was traumatized in this way as a boy, what was your reaction as this legislation was signed?
It was an honor to be part of it, to be behind it, pushing it. We still have more work to do, but this has been a 7-year battle for me since I first been elected, and I've been speaking about this before I was even elected, and Representative McGeehan out of Philadelphia has been fighting for this before. So it's an honor to finally get it done and protect our future children of the state.
You mentioned a 7-year battle. What were the issues involved?
I mean, the main issue, no doubt about it, was the Catholic Conference lobbying group, the Insurance Federation lobbying group. You know, you would think that these laws to protect our children would be an easy go for legislators, but because of the amount of money that those two lobbying groups have been spending just trying to protect the pedophiles and the bishops and the church. We just couldn't move the legislation forward until we actually came to a compromise with Senator Scarnati on the issue.
Let's get to the particulars of the new laws. A main piece of this legislation gets rid of the statute of limitations for criminal prosecution in future child sex abuse cases. What does this do for victims?
It's historic, truly. I try to put it in perspective for people because, you know, you tell people that we're eliminating the criminal statute of limitation and they would think, oh, that seems normal. The current statute of limitation before was age 50. But why this is really historic is most of these victims in this, in all the grand jury reports, they only had a criminal statute of limitations for 5 years. So think about that. Even if you were age 10, you only had till age 15 to come forward and criminally prosecute your predator. Now you have unlimited amount of time. A lot of victims that I speak to, you know, they come forward for the first time, and when I talk to them, most of them are over the age of 50. So truly to give victims the ability to come forward when they're ready is truly historic.
Extraordinarily difficult for a child to talk about something like this, and especially if it involves someone who they love or admire.
Absolutely. I mean, the abuse that is coming from the Catholic clergy is only about 5-6% of the total abuse. Most abuse is coming from within the family, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your uncle. You know, then we have your high school and public school students, and we have now Jehovah's Witnesses and Solbury School. The amount of abused children in this state, when I got elected, I said it truly had been the epicenter for child sex abuse. And finally, now we're going to give victims their rights.
We do have to be careful, at least with the statute of limitations piece of all this, to say future victims. This doesn't apply to those whose cases have fallen outside the old statute of limitations?
That is correct. Everything that was in House Bill 962, my bill, was all prospective legislation. Now, House Bill 963 is what created the 2-year window for all past victims of abuse. And it is in a constitutional amendment form instead of a statutory change.
So why do lawmakers want to see this enshrined as a constitutional amendment?
Well, many believe in the Senate, and this is why we haven't been able to pass a statutory change for the last 7 years, that they believe looking back retroactively will be unconstitutional because they believe that Pennsylvania has a special remedies clause in the Constitution that would not allow it. So many senators took the position that if they do a statutory change and it got put up in front of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, that it would not be held up. And they didn't want victims going through this entire process only to find out that the change that we made was unconstitutional and it couldn't help anybody retroactively. So they have, you know, between myself, Senator Scarnati, and Senator Jay Cornyn, came to the agreement, okay, if that is your true belief, then let's do a constitutional amendment to actually change the Constitution to say it is constitutional. Now, the process...
it's time-consuming.
It does. I mean, it won't be, you know, the earliest that we can get it into law would be 2021, another year and maybe a half out, even if we did pass a statutory change, everybody knows that it would be held up in the courts for years, too. That could be 2, 3, 4 years just because the church lawyer's holding it up as well. So I think when you actually map it out side by side, I don't think there's much of a difference in the path to the end here. You know, you go through the statutory change, the courts could take a long time. We do the constitutional change, it's going to take an extra year, passes through the House and Senate. But in my belief, it probably becomes law a lot faster.
Yeah, and then it goes to the voters as a referendum.
Correct.
So just quickly, before we move on to some other pieces of this legislation, pushback about such an amendment came from people like Republican Representative Chris Dush. She says he's concerned about, you know, a flood of litigation based on allegations that are too old to be effectively defended. Mm-hmm. Is this a concern that old evidence is long gone?
For many of the victim survivors out there, you know, We've never forgotten what happened to us. And for a special group of us, especially within the Catholic Church, they have all the evidence there through their secret files. They have everything documented. So that kind of argument is kind of, you know, put to the side here. And we know, as a victim, if you don't have evidence, you can't go into a civil court and try to sue anybody without evidence. Your case would be thrown out. Mm. So we usually hear that type of argument from people like that support the Catholic Conference or support the Insurance Federation, trying to protect them versus protect their victims. In my belief, hey, if you're a victim, you can go through the process, but if you don't have evidence, you can't move forward.
We are speaking with Pennsylvania State Representative Mark Rossi about some legislation that he championed regarding child sexual abuse victims and new laws which strengthen their legal ability to prosecute and sue abusers. Mark, hard to believe that in the case of children who were sexually abused, there were confidentiality agreements in place in lawsuit settlements which prohibited victims from talking to police. That is no longer the case.
That's absolutely right. That is a huge change moving forward. Again, especially within the church when, you know, they would make you kind of take these settlements privately and then have you sign these confidentiality reports. And that way they could move the priest to the next parish without any other information coming out about that predator. And now we're saying, listen, you abuse, you take a settlement, you're not confined not to speak to police. You can speak to anybody that's in, you know, the police, tell your story, identify your predator. That's a huge move forward.
Another measure clarifies and increases penalties for mandated reporters who don't report suspected child abuse. Who are mandated reporters? What are the penalties?
Well, everybody's a mandated reporter literally anymore, especially when you deal with children. And all this law is saying is that if you know that a predator has been abusing children and you don't report it and you allow that abuse to go on, we're just increasing the penalties, which is absolutely fair. We have seen some circumstances where adults had known that these children were being abused and looked the other way and did nothing, did not call police, did not tell authorities. So increasing the penalties is definitely, we're hoping that people will just do the right thing. If you're not sure, just call Childline and do the right thing.
What sorts of penalties are we talking about?
We're increasing fines. We're also increasing it from, I believe, from the first time being a misdemeanor to the second time being a felony. So we're just increasing the amount of jail time that's possible if this goes on.
Well, how would you respond, Mark, to the teacher, you know, the neighbor, the parent who might be hesitant, who says, well, I'm not sure if this is abuse. And, you know, if it isn't and I say something, you know, it could really damage somebody else. How do you handle a tough situation like that? How should that be handled?
Right. And we often, you know, that's a great question because we often do hear that. But we would rather have the adult err in their judgment here and make the phone call. Even, you know, if you're just not sure, call Childline. And if once they review the claim, if it's validated, they're just going to throw it out. So, but in the mistake of protecting a child, make the phone call.
Mark, I know you've told your story on Radio Times before. Just, you know, briefly, I'd read that you'd never planned to tell anyone the truth about what happened to you.
Absolutely. That day that I ran out of that rectory with my childhood friend who was in the room with me the day I got raped, we ran out and we looked at each other and said, you know, let's not talk about this and I'll see you at school on Monday. And I can remember running home and I was running through one of the fields and I was like, I got to take this to my grave. There's nobody should know about what happened here today. What are my friends going to think? What are they going to, you know, think of me? And well, what names are they going to call me? And I was so embarrassed and I felt guilty for something I didn't even understand. And I just thought it would be easier if I swallow it and compartmentalize it and take it to my grave. And I thought it was really going to stay that way until March 26th of 2009, when my second childhood friend took a gun, put it to his chest, and killed himself, who was also abused by the same priest. And then I knew I had no choice but to speak up on this matter.
Is there healing for you today?
I wish I could say even just passing these laws make it feel better or make it right. I don't think anything is ever going to make this right. I think I have to continue. I'm back in therapy again for probably the fourth or fifth time in my life dealing with this issue. And I really had to gear up my own personal therapy just because of dealing with so many victims and hearing their stories. It's just so traumatic over and over. It's like I never get away from the abuse. I'm constantly reliving the abuse in my job here, because I hear from victims not only from the Commonwealth, but from all over the nation and the world. So it's sometimes it's really hard to take that step back and look what we accomplished with these laws. And I'm hoping one day I'm going to be able to get to do that. But right now I'm just really focused on my own mental health and trying to move forward myself.
Is there enough access to therapy for people who have been abused, sexually abused as children?
Is that a lot of the insurances didn't cover a lot for mental health. And that's one of the things that Senator Lisa Baker added into our bill, was to give adult victims and child victims some money through the state victims compensation fund for counseling. And that's hugely beneficial. It will be for those victims in the future. I think it, you know, therapy is definitely a way forward, just to be able to talk about your own personal abuse and find out. A lot of the questions that I always want to answer was, why me? Why did he pick me? And why did my institution allow this priest to be at, you know, 15 different parishes? Why did they move him around? Why did they move him to my church? And why was I allowed to be collateral damage? And there's so many of those answers that I'm always going to be looking for. I think I'm never going to get. And unfortunately, I often say, I wish I could just take a putty knife and scrape this out of my head. Yeah. And maybe I will forget it then. But unfortunately, when you have this type of trauma when you're a child, I don't think that you ever really will be able to forget.
How do we better provide opportunity for children to say what they need to say as soon as possible about something that's so devastating?
I think right off the bat, and it goes back to the reporting part, is we have to believe our children when they tell you that certain circumstances have happened, or noticing that a child is withdrawing or pulling themselves away from certain adults. We have to be able to notice these little things and just reach out your hand and ask the child in a delicate way, you know, about what's going on. But if we never ask, we'll never find out. And that's one of the things I say is, well, listen, if we err because we're trying to do something good to protect this child, so be it. You know, we have to put our children first. We often say in this Commonwealth that we want to give our kids all the tools and education that they need to be successful. But if we don't talk about protecting them in that same breath, then we have failed them.
Well, Mark, unfortunately, we are out of time, but we really appreciate you coming back to speak with us on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Rossi is a Democratic state representative from Berks County and prime sponsor of legislation which overhauls child sex abuse statutes in the state of Pennsylvania. Don't forget to join us on social media. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. So good to have you with us for Radio Times.